Hey, everybody, you're listening to Potential Energy, where the science, tech, and economics of energy come together. I'm your host, Kirsten Sanford, and on today's show, we are going to talk about water. I'm joined in the studio today by Alex Lindsay.
Hello, hello.
Hello. And Keith Casto, and you have a disclaimer.
Yes, I'm the lawyer in the crowd, so I've got to say this, but I'm a partner at the law firm of Sedgwick, Dieter, Moran, and Arnold, and I specialize in environmental and energy law, and the opinions and statements that I make today are not to be considered the opinions of either my law firm or our clients and should not be relied upon as legal advice. Thank you.
But I do like to hear what you have to say, so I'm glad you're here today. And we are joined by Skype, daisy chained by phone, by
hung together with baling wire.
That's right, and lots of duct tape, spit and duct tape. We are joined by Professor Mark Shannon from the University of Illinois. He is a materials sciences researcher. Hello.
Hi, I'm glad to be on board here.
Yeah, you work in material sciences. Can you give us a little background into...
Well, I'm actually my main department is actually mechanical science and engineering, but I direct a National Science Foundation Center. It's a national center called the Water Campus, which is the advanced materials for the purification of water with systems, and we call it the Water Campus. And it's we have 9 universities from MIT, Yale, Rutgers, Clark Atlanta, Michigan, Notre Dame, Berkeley, UCLA, and Rose Holman, and of course the University of Illinois, which is where I'm talking to you from. And we work on developing new technologies, new science and technology to purify water for human use to make it better, cheaper, use less chemicals, use less energy, recover energy, all sorts of different technologies to try to improve how we purify water.
That's wonderful. And our final guest is Matt Rees from the Water Environment Federation. Welcome.
Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome. Could you give us a little bit of your background, Matt?
Certainly. I am an environmental engineer, and I work as the Managing Director of Technical and Educational Services at the Water Environment Federation. A little explanation about our organization. The Water Environment Federation is a not-for-profit educational organization that has about 35,000 members, mainly in North America, but also around the world. The constituencies that work with us are mainly professionals in the industry of the water environment, the dealing with issues of wastewater and stormwater and watersheds. We also work with those operators who run those wastewater treatment plants, academics who are involved with these types of issues, doing research on various types of materials, such as we just heard about. Government officials and regulators, also the general public, people who are interested in water issues in general. So as an educational organization, we're involved with getting information out and to the general public, putting on a number of conferences each year. We have a scholarly journal, a number of magazines, and other ways in which we are educating the professional about issues of importance to the water environment.
And one of your, you have a conference that's coming up very shortly here, the WEFTEC conference?
Yes, the WEFTEC conference, that stands for the Water Environment Federation Technology Exhibition and Conference. It's the world's largest annual water conference. It's going to be held in Chicago this year, and we rotate it around the country. Very excited that we hope to have over 20,000 people attending this year, and it's a combination of an exposition of over 1,000 companies who are there selling and showing off their wares, the latest technologies dealing with the water treatment. And also we have over 500 papers that will be presented and posters on various issues covering water quality.
Sounds like a lot of fun. Sounds like it's going to be, it sounds like something that's going to become probably more and more observed by the public as water becomes more and more of an issue.
Yes, that's right. I think earlier on the Federation has been around since 1928 and was founded by water professionals, we realized that more and more we can't work within our own silo of water professionals here. We need to be engaging regulators. We need to be engaging the general public. We need to be working on public communications and education, because we're all responsible for water quality. It's not just those who are working on the treatment plant side of things.
And so with that, I'd just like to get started talking about water. Water is something that I think so many people, it comes out of a tap. Usually it's free. I mean, here in the United States, we are so lucky in the water that we have. You know, you turn on a tap, water flows freely. Normally it's clean. I just did a little brief Twitter survey to find out, you know, tap water versus bottled water. What do you choose? And the majority of people do actually, in at least in the Twitterverse, they choose tap water. We trust the water that comes out of the tap, and the water, we take showers. You can run the water forever as long as you can pay for it. You know, the water is in your toilet. You water your plants. Only in times of drought do we all of a sudden come head to head with the issue that water is a limited resource. And water is not just something that comes from a tap and is in our house and that we drink or that we buy in bottles. Water is also used for creating energy. Water is used by industry. Water is used for farming. And most of the water that is necessary for these services, for these things that make daily life possible, is fresh water. And fresh water is hard to come by. It's very, very interesting. I was looking at an article from Scientific American's new publication. I think they have a special issue out this month called Earth 3.0. And there's an article called Energy Versus Water that's written by Michael Weber out of, I believe, the University of Texas. And in the beginning of the article, he brings up the fact that, you know, we all might be familiar with the fact that Georgia went through an extreme drought within the last year. And the water that flows through Georgia into the Apalachicola River runs down into Florida. There's also water that goes into Alabama, and the Army Corps of Engineers was going to shut down or limit the water that was going out of Georgia into these states. Florida threatened a lawsuit because it was worried about endangered species in the Everglades not getting enough water, and Alabama was worried about having to turn off its nuclear power plants. Georgia, however, you know, they're dealing with the drought, and one of the legislators actually suggested that they move their upper border a mile up into Tennessee to do a land grab and actually change the water rights so that they can get more water. And this was based on a questionable border survey from back in 1818. And it just, I think to me, this story just kind of draws to the forefront all of the various areas in which water affects our daily lives. Keith, you have a comment?
Well, I was just going to say is that comment triggers what may be happening in the future, the water wars. There's been a lot of water litigation over the years in the West. It's been largely absent in the East, but Georgia's a good example where all of a sudden water has become an issue so that legal issues become involved. So as water shortages increase, I think you'll see a lot of these issues litigated in the courts. As Tocqueville said, it seems like everything ends up in the courts, and so will water shortages.
Well, I think we, this is in the United States, but I think according to, there's an article that we have here from Christian Science Monitor that says that in Barcelona, I guess, it's a $13,000 fine if you're caught watering your flowers. You know, they are shipping, you know, water, wow, fresh water in. So this is something that's really becoming a much more, moving to the forefront.
But Barcelona, I think, this is Mark Shannon just weighing in. Barcelona, they are shipping. They're spending, I think, $26 million every 3 months,
wow,
to have water brought in by ship from wells in the south of France. But at the same time, over a length of a year, they are discharging huge amounts of water out of their subway system and discharging it because it's not clean enough for human use. And it strikes me that people say, well, they would rather have water brought in at huge cost from a well in south of France rather than cleaning up the water they have or reusing the water and at least being able to supply non-potable water. So it's indicative of, in my way of thinking, that people are still completely say, stovepipes or pipes, they think, oh, well, there's drinking water, there's storm sewer water, there's, you know, sewer water, storm water, there's all these different types of water. Right. But from my perspective, water is water, and we need to start thinking of it holistically in an integrated fashion.
Yeah, Mark, this is Ben. I'm so glad you brought that up, and that term you used, water is water, we're fond of using that around here at the Water Environment Federation. I'd mentioned that a lot of our constituents deal with the wastewater side of the equation, but there's also the drinking water side, and there's stormwater issues, too. When our organization was founded, we were called the Federation of Sewage Works Associations. Over time, the mission of our organization has changed to be looking more holistically at water and therefore have evolved into the Water Environment Federation. And you're absolutely right that water is water, and that example in Spain is perfect, that through a bit of contamination of water, people aren't willing to even consider using that or reusing that. And we have to simply change the mindset of the way that people look at water, think about water, and use water, because we're in an unsustainable paradigm right now. And we need to be thinking differently about water as a resource.
Keith?
Yes, and here in the West, the mandate for using gray water, that is water that is not potable but certainly usable for certain purposes, has been mandated for a long time, and it diverts from the total stock of water into non-potable uses, a tremendous amount of water that doesn't have to be fully treated. And I think that goes to a long-term regime where you manage water according to use.
Now, one of the things that I was in some discussions with some folks that they're dealing with a lot of this in the Denver area, mm-hmm. You know, of running out of water, where you have a lot of farm use as well as a lot of population use. And one of the things that was brought up, and I'm kind of curious what our experts have to say about this, is the idea of localizing water treatment, where the problem is that, you know, what if we just not put it's something that's been floated in that area of we're just going to run non-potable water through most of the pipes and then have it go into, you know, purification at the houses where certain pipes are, you know, certain things like what you're watering your lawn with and what goes into your toilet is different than what goes into your sink. What do you? I'm just curious what our experts have to say.
Well,
about that.
I'm going all over the world advocating this, okay. This approach, and we have got to move in that direction. The United States. In fact, I had a discussion early this morning with a young faculty from Houston, saying that the United States is probably trailing quite a bit the rest of the world in innovation and in moving in directions of water from an integrated fashion. Israel is certainly way ahead of us, as well as other countries. But if we don't deal with exactly what you're saying, as looking at distributed systems, and we look at point discharge, point use, point source applications, where we can dramatically improve the quality of water, reduce the amount of water lost and leakage in through systems, and be more thinking about this integrated fashion. We don't need to have massive amounts of water discharged into a sewer system, mm-hmm. turn around, treat it, discharge it to a river, then pump it back for drinking water. We treat it all to a drinking water standard and for both potable and non-potable. It uses a lot of energy. It uses a lot of chemicals, which impact the environment, and it makes a lot more sense to deal with it on a per-use basis. And other countries find that not that it makes sense, it is essential to their survival. And it will be in parts of our country as well.
Yes, that's a discussion we're having also at the Water Environment Federation. And what we have in place almost exclusively in the United States now, when you look at urban systems specifically, is that we have what I would call a big pipe system.
Yep.
That is a centralized system where water comes from one particular source, be it surface water or groundwater or desalination in some cases, and comes through a centralized system where it's treated and then distributed out to everybody's home or apartment or business or industry. It's then used. Most people see the 12 inches of water between their faucet and their drain, and they don't think about much else.
Right.
But then after that, it goes through another large network of pipes, a collection system as we call it, and those collection systems can be huge, hundreds if not thousands of miles in some of the larger systems, big enough in some cities to drive a car down, literally, and they come to a centralized wastewater treatment plant. Now, at the same time, we need to recognize the great advances that centralized wastewater treatment and water treatment have provided to for human health and for human sanitation. But that's a lot of infrastructure that is, and a lot of it which is reaching the end of its useful life. It's been in the ground for 50, 60, 70 or longer years. So that's where this concept of decentralizing our water distribution and collection system starts to come into play. And can you have point-of-use water, as Mark was just talking about? Can we collect rainwater and work with rainwater harvesting concepts? And it's a fascinating idea, and although when you really get down to it, there are some issues that still need to be worked out. What we have right now is with that centralized system, we have centralized management also. And in big cities, you may have an authority or an organization that oversees it all, and they have responsibility, and they have ratepayers, the citizens who pay for that service, and they are responsible for that. When you decentralize that, and let's say you put in, I'm sure we'll get to talking about membranes here in a bit, which mm-hmm. is Mark's area of expertise. If you put a membrane system in the basement of a building, and they've done this in some buildings, the Solaire Project in New York City is one example, where they treat the wastewater in the basement of that building and reuse the water. It is it's an interesting concept, but who's responsible for the management of that particular technology? And yeah. So we've had some examples that work, but the scaling up of that is going to be a challenge to address. It's not just the technical issues sometimes that are going to keep us from moving ahead. Sometimes it's management issues, and other times it's public acceptance, too. As I mentioned, the public needs to understand that the back to this water is water concept.
Yeah, I think there's a lot there with the public interpretation.
Well, and I have to admit,
it.
I grew up in a localized system because, you know, I grew up on a farm.
Right.
So we had our own way of managing our own water coming in because we didn't have it. We didn't grow up on a pipe. You know, so it's not that we don't have the technologies or don't have things going on there. That's the stuff is, you know, the technology is available, but it is something that does have to be constantly managed.
Yeah, and the one point that you brought up is the management of it. So maybe larger systems that are put into, housing developments or into large apartment buildings or, large company buildings, maybe that would work very well. And, you know, you have one person who's in charge of the management. But I'm just wondering how well that kind of a system would work for individual homes or, you know, that just seems like it's asking for trouble.
Well, you know, I always like to remind people that people have been using well water and septic systems throughout the United States and world for hundreds of years. There's still tens of millions of Americans who use that system to this day. My parents live in mm-hmm. Silicon Valley, and they bought their place years and years back when it was a orchard, but they're still on well water and a septic system, and they're surrounded by city.
Yeah.
So it's a system that people don't think twice about it if they, you know, have a good functioning well, and they don't need to test it as often. But there's a new business model that's coming out, and you know, with the communication systems and everything wireless and being on the internet, there's companies. I know of a California company that basically is building these small treatment plant, these little MBR systems, membrane bioreactor systems, where they have it hooked up so that they can see what's happening, so that should it go bad, they can send maintenance people out, and it doesn't even have to involve the homeowner. So there are ways of approaching this problem, because it does need to be robust. It does need to be a really good system. Anybody yeah. who's had their septic system go bad knows that, you know, things aren't so great. But
yeah.
but there's there are new business models and businesses that are coming out, and I've seen them functioning just spectacularly well in other countries, particularly in Europe. This is not, while it's maybe new in concept to people in the United States, many places of the world are already adopting these technologies in a major way.
And there's also some examples here of taking the management approach of a centralized system and applying it to decentralized. I'll give an example here on Washington, D.C., in Loudoun County, which is one of the far western suburbs. They have a centralized treatment plant that treats a good portion of the wastewater from the county, but at the same time, they have many decentralized systems. And they actually have a position at that utility, which is the manager of decentralized systems. So what they're doing is take a centralized management approach to a decentralized technology approach.
Mm.
And that's one way of approaching the situation.
That's interesting. Keith, did you have a comment?
Yes. I think one of the factors that has to be considered in decentralization is, and there's been, I believe, a 60 Minutes program on it and some other programs, is sort of the corruption associated with the privatization of water supplies. And I think it basically what it comes down to is private water companies that have been created that have essentially abused their authority and have gone largely unregulated. And so when you shift from sort of a public agency model so that manages water in a centralized basis to a privatized, decentralized business model, you have to be careful that there's somebody sort of minding the store and making sure that there is not excessive profits and essentially misuse and misdirection of water sources.
I'd like to move on a little bit into the actual purification of the water. So, Mark, if maybe you could tell us a little bit about where we are with these new membrane technologies. And like Matt, you had said earlier that these membrane technologies are really changing the face of the water purification industry. Maybe, Mark, you can start the conversation.
Well, sure. Well, membrane's actually been around for a while. I think they're... The fact that more than 50% of desal and a lot of treatment systems are now becoming membrane based is because it's really gaining a lot of market penetration, and there's some history to know that it in fact works, and there's some experience that people have, and like any technology that really starts to diffuse into regular use, people have got to understand the technology and know what to do when things go wrong and know how to fix it. And things really need to be robust. There's the two, I always like to say, the two things that really changed the face of the world in terms of numbers of people and their health was very robust technology. One was given to us by the Romans, the water, the air break, where you separated the supply system from the sewer system by the water flowing through the air, which many places in the world still don't do. And then, of course, chlorine and chlorination and treatment so that you could kill the pathogens. The next wave has really been where we have a barrier, and that's the membrane. And it provides a barrier to one side of water that would not be so clean to the side being clean. And so they're in all sorts of sizes. There's these little tiny membrane reverse osmosis units. My parents actually have one underneath their sink because their well is now so deep that salt water intrusion, it's salty water now. Mm. That's also occurring all over the world. But, there's these small units that are being sold that are, hundreds of thousands of these that people are using all over the world. And then there's going all to these really large systems, like I just was in Israel looking at their plants at Ashkelon and Palerim, where they're just enormous and you producing lots and lots of water. So they range from anywhere from, underneath your sink to plants that are enormous in size, producing lots of water. And their efficacy of being able to separate out contaminants and keep one thing on one side and another on the other side are getting better. Membrane bioreactors to treating wastewater, where you can leave microbes and they stay on one side and then the water flows through the membrane and then you can treat it further and make it cleaner even for non-potable and use or even getting to potable even. But there's going to be public acceptance problems there, but you can get water so clean. There's a growing acceptance. That doesn't mean that there aren't problems and things can't be done better. There's still cleaning and fouling problems. There's making sure if you're using reverse osmosis to desalinate water that you put back some of the important minerals that are taken out by it, magnesium, sulfates, and calcium, and various other ones. But I think we'll see this growth being even more rapid as people begin to understand the technology and they begin to have more trust in it and we get a good history and people who can service them. And the way I say this servicing, if it really is truly distributed, you have lots of choices in the marketplace, sort of like you have people producing furnaces and air conditioning units and you have lots of different companies and how well they supply it, they'll get a customer base or not. Mm-hmm. You do need to worry about monopolies and people who are monopolistic, because then you could get into the problem discussed earlier. But I think we'll see a lot more happening in membranes, but also other technologies, technologies that are involving, you know, catalysts and you know, some nanotechnologies that are coming to boot that can really improve the quality of water without having to use so many powerful chemicals and energy. And I think that's really where the wave of the future is.
Yeah.
Well, one question I have is related to the adding minerals back in. Now, what is the real important factor? Why do we need to add those some of these minerals back into the water after we've removed everything out of the water on its way in?
Well, one is that if you're going to distribute it in a distribution system, you want to make sure that the water has the right pH and hardness so that it doesn't cause leaching of the pipes, the metals in the pipes, because if it's very, very pure water, then it's, you know, it can cause problems with dissolving of pipes and so you want to add it back to being a natural. Humans also like a flavor that has some of these in there. I mean, we buy, you know, Perrier water and mineral water because we like the taste. And we prefer the taste over you know, deionized water or distilled water. But from an agricultural point of view, if we're going to use water for agriculture, which is already being done in some parts of the world from desalination, it's still rather expensive for, at least by U.S. standards. But yeah. The plants need things. I'm putting magnesium sulfate back in the water, the pipes, helps plants grow. And in fact, it's in natural water systems as it is. We call it Miracle-Gro, and people probably seen Miracle-Gro before, but that's, you know, really concentrated versions of it. And then, of course, we want to make sure that certain elements that, you know, certain things are taken out of it that shouldn't be there, like boron and you know, bromine and other things. So there's still work that needs to be done to improve it. But generally, we like water to have a certain, to be as close to the way good natural water would be.
Kirsten, you mentioned before the question about membranes changing how wastewater is treated conventionally.
Yeah.
And the technology improvements that Mark's been talking about here are fascinating. And it really is changing the industry. I mentioned before the Water Environment Federation has their big annual conference, WEFTEC. We do a number of other smaller specialty conferences on topics like disinfection and residuals and biosolids, nutrient removal, emerging contaminants, and EDCs. And we started doing a conference recently on membrane technologies. It's that a technology has become such a hot item within the sector that there's enough programming and interest to support its own recurring event. And we held this event in Atlanta appropriately earlier this year.
Yeah.
And we had, as one of the speakers, was a gentleman named Andrew Benedict, and he was the former CEO of Xenon, which is a company that manufactures membranes. They've since been sold to a large multinational company. And I think that's another a way of trying to assess the interest in this technology. When you have companies like GE and Siemens getting into the game, you know there's something interesting happening here. And Mr. Benedict made a comment that membranes have crashed the conventional treatment barrier, meaning that they have now come down in price that they would be equal to or equivalent to a conventional treatment. And these are the types of treatments that have been used for, as I mentioned, decades.
Mm-hmm.
And so there really is a bit of a sea change here. And one I mentioned before, that sustainable approaches is something that is important to the Water Environment Federation. And as you look at conventional treatment technologies and what's been used for so long in this country and all over the world, it involves a lot of what we'll call reactors or tanks, where you're putting a lot of energy through air through the wastewater, and it's this huge reactor that's treating the wastewater, and then you send it over to another tank that's a clarifier, and it removes the solids from the water, and you get a clean, clarifying effluent to come out the back end. While it works good, it requires a lot of land. It requires a lot of materials to build it, and with concrete and iron for rebar shortages around the world, having a smaller footprint to your plant is important. Membranes allow you to do that, and also will produce often a better quality effluent that may be reused. So there's a lot of benefits to this, and as the costs start to come down, they're starting to displace what we would call conventional wastewater treatment.
I mean, do we see membranes as the solution that we're going to eventually get to? I mean, are we going to give up a lot of the other ways that we do this, or is it just another tool in the tool chest?
I'd say right now, the way the market is looking, it is another tool. There are a lot of other ways to treat water and treat wastewater, and effective ways to do that. But the technology is evolving rapidly. It's appropriate for using, and when you come back to that discussion we had before about decentralized systems, to be able to treat to a very high level of effluent quality in a very small space, like the basement of an apartment building, mm-hmm. There are few technologies that can match the treatment capabilities of membranes. So, and as the costs start to come down, one of the downsides to membranes historically, although the manufacturers are working very hard on this, is that membrane bioreactors, that is membranes that are used to treat wastewater, use a lot of energy. And as we all know, energy costs are going up. So that's an issue that does need to be resolved, and they are working at trying to develop more energy-efficient membrane bioreactor systems.
Now, what about, you know, most people have like a Brita water filter, you know, a chunk of carbon or a bunch of carbon that filters the water and pulls out impurities. What is the benefit of using a membrane system over just a carbon filtering system?
Activated carbon is used a lot, and when it's new and fresh, activated carbon is wonderful, and it has lots of what we call absorption sites. It has places where contaminants can absorb to. And what most people probably don't do is replace their filters nearly enough, because they put it on and they then leave it. And it doesn't take very, very long before all those sites are filled up and the carbon then stops acting as the filter. And people don't recognize that it's no longer providing them the protection. And so then if they leave it in, like I know many people, way, way too long, it actually provides a place for stuff to grow on itself, bacteria and other things. So membranes that are, because it's a filter is not a barrier. It's an absorbent. It's things absorb to it. Mm-hmm. I use these types of filters all the time, but I know about this and I replace them frequently. So, and maybe I'm not trying to do a commercial for Brita, but maybe people should replace their filters more. But the thing is that membranes are barriers, and they're designed to stop something. And what happens is, over time, as it fills up, you'll get less and less water, and it's sort of self-limiting, and you'll have to clean it or replace it because you won't get the water to come through. And so it sort of is as a barrier, it can do a better job over and be more robust as long as there's not any defects and it doesn't break. So there is still some work that has to be done to make sure that we know that it's doing its job. And there's people working on sensors right along with it so we can know when the thing is doing its job and when it's not. Maybe a light will go off or some to notify you that it's time to replace it.
What about desalination? We've mentioned desalination a couple of times here. It seems like, you know, the oceans are full of water, right? Why can't we tap into the ocean water more efficiently than we are? What's going on with desalination and why aren't we taking more advantage of it?
Well, I'll talk about some of the general issues, and Mark may want to talk about some of the technology issues specifically, but desal is an option. It is being considered. It's often being considered as part of a suite of options that would be in combination with some type of surface water use or groundwater, and that does provide some flexibility and I'll use the word again, sustainability in a water supply to have various options. Desal, like other membrane systems right now, do require a lot of energy. You have to build up a high pressure to be removing those salts. And that pressure buildup comes from pumps, and those pumps require energy to use. And so there is an energy component, certainly, that is a part of desalination. There's also the brackish water that is produced, and often you will find some environmental objections to installation of a desalination facility because of the output, not the clean water, but the brackish water that is produced on the other end of it. Mark, on the technology side?
Well, you know, there's lots of things that are going on the desal, just because, you know, like I like to say, 99.23% of the earth water on Earth is not currently usable by humans, and much of that 97% is in the seas. And just as much saline aquifers and saline lakes and brackish water exists under continents as freshwater aquifers.
Hmm.
In fact, perhaps more. And many people around this country are already finding that their wells are so deep that they're starting to reach that point. As you go deeper, it tends to get saltier. So there's another really big issue, and that's what one does. If you're along the sea, you have access to seawater. And if you need it inland, then you have to transport it inland. So not only do you pay to desalinate the water, typically when you push it inland, you have to transport it inland, and often inland means up. And so you have to use a lot more energy to get it there. So even aside from what does one do with the brine disposal and you know, people working on different types of outflows to try to make it better, and you read about lots of people doing different techniques. But once you're inland, you know, there's salt water everywhere. I mean, for instance, El Paso, Texas, their wells are so deep now that their water comes out and they actually have to treat it. And then they take their brine that comes out of this concentrated brine, and they transport it some 20 miles away and inject it into a deep old oil well to get rid of it.
Wow.
Very expensive. So what do you do with this brine is which one point. And then what do you do about transporting water? So there's lots of work that's going on to try to figure out how can we cut the energy use and what can we do about the residuals, the brine. Can we
Is the brine useful for anything?
Well, if you can get it concentrated enough, if you can get it, and particularly the inland one, if you can get it to a solid affordably, and we can talk about that for just in a second. Yeah, it has a lot of calcium carbonate, magnesium, silicates, and other materials that are actually have some commercial value. And so it does have some value, not hugely valuable, but it has some. The problem is that the way people currently have been doing this is if you want to, you can, if you're in the desert area, the arid Southwest, some people have been pouring it out onto the desert and letting the sun evaporate it. The problem with that approach is it takes up land. And some of the stuff that you're concentrating when you're concentrating is also things that aren't so good, heavy metals and other things that are in it. And so you've got to be careful that you're not creating a toxic waste dump. And then if it gets a big heavy rain, which periodically happens in the arid Southwest, then it overflows and rolls out. And now you've created a salty mess and everywhere. So that approach has been losing favor, and you can see why.
Yeah.
And then the other approach is, well, what else do you do if you want to get it to a solid? Well, if you have to use natural gas to heat it up, I mean, that's really expensive, right? So there's techniques that people are working on, and I know of many different techniques. Other techniques than reverse osmosis, forward osmosis. I've seen some, you know, a couple of really just really clever schemes that I just came back from the Netherlands where people are working on taking it out right out to a solid. And if these things eventually catch place, you might see a much greater acceptance of desalination. This brine disposal problem, when I go around telling people, is probably the problem that's going to prevent implementation. If we talk about energy, yes, it's energetic compared to, you know, fresh water. But if you're taking water from, say, Northern California, and you're pumping it to Southern California, by the time it gets there, it has taken far more energy than if they just desalinated seawater right there in Los Angeles. So, again, you have to compare. Pumping over the Tehachapi takes energy, pumping it and taking it down through all that distance. And so, you know, if we're building dams and building big canals and building big pump systems, be careful, because it could end up being far more energy than if you're doing desal. I think the brine issue is an important one. And as we come up with better solutions, we might see much greater acceptance of desalination.
Right. And the need for desalination is certainly not going to go away. As you look at climate models and changes to climate, the impacts that it may have, with rise in sea levels, you're going to have more wells, as you were talking about, becoming more saline. With glacier melt patterns becoming different than historically you were used to, that changes the flow of rivers. You mentioned the Netherlands, and they're tracking this closely because the flow of their rivers out to the sea are changing from what they are historically used to. And what that happens is during lower periods of flow, that saltwater intrusion in the rivers are coming further up. So plants that used to not, water treatment plants, that used to not worry about saline waters are now having to deal with salt in their raw water intakes. So, and this is being repeated all over the globe. So the issue of desalination is certainly going to just increase in importance and need.
Keith, do you know if there's any legislation, like are there any concerns here in California specifically regarding desalination, the placement of desalination plants? Or
yes, there's two basic ways that they're regulated. First of all, under the Clean Water Act, you can't put it back in the water or any place that looks like it's a discharge of a pollutant. Secondly, to the extent that it does concentrate heavy metals, mercury, and other contaminants, it has to be disposed of in a landfill as a hazardous waste. If it gets reinjected, as we've been talking about, you can't do that without complying with the requirements for disposal of hazardous waste. So between those two, whether you dispose of it on land or water, you have to comply with regulatory requirements, and that actually, along with the energy cost, raises the cost of desalination as a viable technology.
So the legal regulatory issues are something are a cost barrier as well. I think it's interesting. You mentioned, I think it was Matt mentioned, like Los Angeles having to consider desalination. Orange County actually has started what they call an Orange County groundwater replenishment system, where they're actually taking sewage water, and I believe they're using they're cleaning up the sewage water, probably using some kind, I don't know if it is some kind of membrane technology, but they are cleaning it up to replenish the city's aquifers. Does it do?
Mm-hmm. That's right. They go through tertiary treatment and then use an RO as a final polish before injecting.
Yeah, and they say it beats either the local or the government, the federal governmental clean water standards, the level to which they're cleaning it. So it seems to me they actually say it's much cheaper to recycle the sewage water than it is to get to the desalination.
When you think about the cost of pumping water, as Mark had said before, from Northern California over the Tehachapis down to L.A., and you can reuse a water source that's already there, that certainly does seem to make sense. I remember I'm on the other coast, and when that plant opened up operation, I was watching it on the news here. And unfortunately, it was advertised as toilet to tap.
Yeah.
Toilet to tap.
Which certainly isn't any way to try to gain public acceptance. And the reality is, as our population grows, as water resources become more and more scarce, projects like this are going to have to become more frequent.
Well, and as the water, I mean, because the big problem when we get back into this water is water, is that there's definitely an incremental increase in the amount of water people are using in a given area, but it's incremental. It's not, we're going to get rid of all this water and then add a whole bunch of new water. But right now what we're doing is we're kind of doing that, right? We're kind of taking, we take in all this water and we, very little of it really gets back. We lose a lot of it in between. So figuring out ways to, isn't it the case that as this starts to become much more expensive, recycling becomes,
like oil.
Well, like oil. People love electric cars when gasoline is $4 a gallon. When water gets, much more expensive, which is, and when we start really bearing the real cost of water, it seems like a lot of these technologies start to spark pretty quickly.
Sure. Water is the new oil, is a term that's been thrown around lately. And you're right. As the costs start to come up, as the demand starts to come up, things are going to have to change. And public perception, which is not an easy thing to change, is going to happen too.
And advertising campaigns, not like toilet to tap.
Well, but I mean,
you need to have new PR.
In the simplest form, we have, we don't, we have an office here. We have a bunch of people here, and most of us don't like the taste of the tap water. We know it's safe. We know it's not going to make us sick. But we don't like drinking it. And so we either have, for these shows, we have little bottles. And for the office, we have the big bottle. And even then, because when you start looking at expenses, you start going, well, it's a lot cheaper for me to buy a filter. And attach a filter system, some kind of filtration system to our tap rather than pay Arrowhead or whoever it is that brings the water into, you know, into our office. You know, it just doesn't. But we're just making a financial decision. You know, it's not as much a environmental issue. We're not looking at it from the wide view. We're just going, well, we'd like to cut our costs in this area, mm-hmm. and I think that's how a lot of people make decisions.
But at the same time, we still need to work on that public perception. And the reality is, we're all reusing the same water over and over again.
That's right.
There's only a very small percentage of the world's water that is available to us. 1% is fresh water that's not caught up in glaciers. And we here in Washington, D.C., as an example, our water supply here comes from, much of it comes from the Potomac River. Well, a lot of that water upstream has come from treatment plants upriver or runoff from fields and pastures, but we have good treatment technologies that are cleaning the water for us, and it is safe. But I think that's essentially indirect reuse. And what they're doing in California, as you just mentioned, is a step closer towards direct reuse. And they do actually have direct reuse in Singapore. There's a plant called the New Water Plant, and they're using membrane filtration to directly reuse wastewater for potable water.
Well, there is a place in the United States, too, Cloudcraft, New Mexico. Basically, they discharge into a pond, and they have their intake for their drinking water in the same pond, and they go over four times a day. So, I mean, that's just a holding tank, right? So it's the first place and the only place I know of in the United States, but it's starting in.
It's treated on the way into the pond, and then I assume on the way out. So
it's treated as discharge from this wastewater into the pond, and then they have the intake for the drinking water in the pond.
Now, how much new water do they need to add to that system on an ongoing basis?
I don't know, actually. Mm-hmm. I don't know the answer to that, but I just know that there's. I mean, we're already starting to see it. It's more direct than the Potomac, But everybody, I always like to say every city, the major city that's on a river system or on a major water system, and most major cities are. That's how they got to be major cities. There's upstream and there's downstream, and you can always know where by the settlements was the wealthier section was upstream and the poorer section was downstream. And
right.
The only exception I could find to that was Chicago, and well, they changed the direction of the river. So
that's right.
And then in fact, this last 5,000-year storm. I did want to talk a little bit about that. They just had a 5,000-year storm. Ike came over and dumped, 10 inches of rain in a short period of time in Chicago.
Yeah.
And they had just finished their big combined sewer overflow system, 150 meters down and huge pipes. And they had these big storms, and this is the second time in 2 years that it overflowed the system. That's really driving a lot of change. That's another big change driver that's going to occur because we just can't. I know there's still a large big pipe constituency out there who really wants to build these big pipes, but I don't think we have the money in this country to do it. Hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars need if we continue with the current technology, and we have to build these big pipes to try to hold this overflow to keep it from mixing with the sewage, to keep it from overflowing into our lakes and rivers. I think that is driving a lot of things to do this non-potable reuse, because the more you can take the wastewater out and start reusing it, you need less and less potable, you need to treat less and less water for the potable supply, and we have less and less problems with overflow. And that, I think, is a financial driver that might drive a lot more reuse.
Hey, Mark, thanks for bringing up the infrastructure issue, and that is something that is very near and dear to our hearts here at the Water Environment Federation.
Yeah.
The EPA did a gap analysis looking at what would be needed to fund water and wastewater infrastructure, and it's $1 trillion over the next 20 years.
And we just spent that.
We just signed it, right.
As we're recording this show, we just dropped $1 trillion. We don't have another one.
Yeah, we don't. And there's some good ways of dealing with this without becoming bankrupt over it. And so I think that's it's one of these things you say people aren't willing to accept it. But if they're going to see a major price hike or a major rate hike versus another approach, I think people will listen.
Yeah.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Well, and there's a lot more talk that I'm seeing in our sector now about the use of green infrastructure versus gray infrastructure. using natural plants and systems to capture rainwater, to treat rainwater and filter it and hold it rather than sending it through an infrastructure system like you have in Chicago, where you have what's called combined sewers. You have both stormwater and sanitary waste, wastewater, going into the same sewer system. So when you get a big storm like that, you have those CSOs, or combined sewer overflows. And the green infrastructure movement is very interesting because it brings together not just engineers, but scientists, planners, and a number of different groups who are interested in taking a more natural, lighter footprint approach. There's this interesting concept called hydrologic invisibility. And I love thinking about this. It's where you would go in to any watershed, for example, and whatever construction you would do there would essentially have no impact on a drop of water that falls in that watershed. If it would otherwise fall and make its way into the ground and the groundwater somehow, if you're going to build a building, you'll put a green roof on it. Or you have some type of rain garden that captures the water off top and makes its way back down into the groundwater again. But you're essentially not messing with Mother Nature. You can still build. That doesn't mean we can't have progress and we can't have roads and highways and buildings. But you're thinking about it from the watershed perspective. And with hydrologic invisibility, you are putting something back to the state it was before we came.
Yeah, roadways that are permeable, so it soaks in and doesn't have to run off, and we don't have to build the big, huge pipes that cause the overflows. I know Chicago is pushing hard on that, as to take street after street. Mostly they're now starting with alleyways, but just to start bringing them and making them porous again, so that when the rain falls, it soaks in.
Well, how do you make them porous? How do you make a road porous?
Well, you know, I mean, we can think it's quaint when we're in the older towns and we see the brick pavers, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm. But there's ones that are not just brick pavers, but they are a lot of places putting in the pavers, and they're very pretty. But they're, you know, there's new structures that they're building where the roadway itself it looks like an asphalt or a concrete, but it's porous.
Hmm. Yep. And water just flows through it. City of Philadelphia is also doing a lot of work in that. They're taking their schoolyards, and it's city property. They have ownership of them, and they are transferring many, many of their schoolyards from big asphalt yards and entire city blocks into something that has porous pavement and rain gardens. And they're doing this to try to address what we talked about before, combined sewer overflows. If you can diminish the volume of stormwater that's flowing off of a permeable site into your sewers and then out into the river, you can reduce or eliminate those combined sewer overflows. And that's one of the primary goals of a lot of these green infrastructure movements.
I just had an opportunity a couple of weeks ago to go and give testimony at Congress with a group of people, including I think someone from your organization, about the importance of thinking about water. And we kept arguing, should we use the word integrated? Would people understand integrated versus holistic? But the basic upshot of the entire discussion was, if we think about water from all different perspectives, we can, this green movement or water is water, we can actually save money and improve the environment and improve our quality of life all at the same time. By staying with the current way of doing it and being locked in and saying we must do it this way and only this way, we're going to run out of money. We can't sustain it. We can't do it. Where the amount of chemicals that we'll be dumping into the waterways, most people don't understand, and I'm not certainly opposed to current treatment methods. I don't want people to take me the wrong way, because unless we have a replacement, it's much better than the alternative. But every time you treat water, we put in lots of things that end up becoming salts, and we salt up rivers and we salt up land. And by the Colorado River, how many times the water comes in and out and flows off the land. The water going into Mexico needs to be desalinated. It's so salty now, and it's not healthy for anybody.
Right.
So taking this from a green perspective is not just being good for the environment, and it's also being good for your pocketbook, being good for your health. It's just a better way of thinking about it.
Well, there are a lot of advantages to green infrastructure. And we did mention earlier in the show a little bit of talk about energy and water and how they tie together. And one of the benefits of green infrastructure installments is that it, in an urban area at least, it can help reduce that urban heat island, which will reduce air conditioning costs in the summer. There's aesthetic benefits. There's habitat benefits even. So the ancillary benefits of going green with infrastructure are endless, and it's great to see the movement heading in that direction.
I think it's I think these comments are just, you know, you're wrapping it up so nicely. I mean, you're bringing it all together. But I'd just like to give everyone an opportunity to give their final thoughts on the issues that we've been talking about so far today. Maybe we'll start with Keith.
Sure. I think this has been a fabulous program, and I think the ideas advanced are innovative and are really absolutely necessary. I think there is, however, a dearth of good body of laws in place to implement it, and I think these good ideas need some legal structure to put them into place. So one of the things that has to be considered by legislatures is advancing these in the way that they're mandated on the water authorities that have to be responsible for the allocation of water.
Alex?
I think that when you listen to this and when you think of all the shows that we're doing, I think this is just another example of, you know, we're getting to a point, a lot of people say we have too many people on Earth. In a lot of ways, we just have to start rethinking the structure that we're working inside of. When we were a little company, we're still a little company, but when we were doing a handful of jobs here and there and we had a couple people, we could operate in a certain way. You could kind of have a couple people and you'd talk about a couple things and you'd do, you know, and it wasn't, you didn't have to be very organized, you know, to make it all work. And one of the things that as we grew as a company, now we have, you know, these big databases that run everything, and we have automated systems that build everything because we have to reduce the amount of energy that we spend dealing with each individual node. And in a lot of ways, whether it's oil or whether it's water, I think what we're seeing here is that we need to, you know, we have a lot more people, like a lot more business that we have to manage, and we're going to have to really rethink, just like a business as it grows, rethinks the infrastructure of how it handles it. We really, to minimize the amount of energy it spends on each individual unit. That's, I think, the thing that is, I think, the recurring theme that we're seeing with not just this one, but I think that a lot of the problems are very similar to the oil issue of just completely rethinking how we're managing the process.
Mark, do you have any final comments?
Well, I really encourage. I thought this discussion was wonderful, and Keith is right. We have got to start thinking about what types of laws and structures, and maybe it's time to restatute the Clean Water Act in some way that can make it more flexible and allow innovation and allow changes to occur that are better for the environment. I think what we're going to see is people around the world are really catching on, but the issues with climate change, the lack of clean water is going to dominate long before the seas rise. When major rivers, of which 1.5 billion people around the world live on, become intermittent, and they're already happening, the Rio Grande, Yellow River, people are going to become desperate, and this is going to be the issue. And there isn't enough energy in the world to use the current methods for pumping and damming rivers, and it's just there's just not enough money, not enough people, not enough energy to do it. So we're going to need to think new ways to purify water.
Thanks. Matt?
Well, first of all, thank you for inviting the Water Environment Federation to be a part of this great conversation.
You're welcome.
You mentioned as we were wrapping up that this is all coming together nicely, and I've talked about the theme of sustainability a couple of times in the conversation, and I think that's really where we need to go in thinking about a sustainable water environment. We have infrastructure needs, and we need to think more sustainably about that, and there's a lot of elements of that that need to come together. We've talked about watersheds, integrated watershed management, the use and additional applications for green infrastructure, energy conservation among our utilities, and the energy-water nexus is a whole other issue. We could talk for another hour about that, but that's so important. And then climate change, as Mark just mentioned, having utilities and its users and the management of watersheds being able to adapt to climate change and also work on the mitigation side also. It's a huge, huge challenge, but it's something that we have no choice but to address.
Well, thank you, everybody, for joining in on this conversation. I've learned a lot just from listening to everyone and all the questions and comments that have come up. I definitely think that water is an issue that needs to be more prominent in the discussion of energy and these green green talks that people are having more and more often. I do agree that water is going to become the prominent issue as we move forward. And we need to make changes, as we do with our energy infrastructure, the water infrastructure. Just things need to change. So thanks, everyone, for bringing all your opinions and information to the table. That about does it for this episode of Potential Energy. Thanks, everyone, for listening. And I hope that you've enjoyed the show. To subscribe and download Potential Energy for free, go to iTunes. And
it's free.
It is free. Search for Potential Energy. And please feel free to email us. Please. I like email. And I can't, I mean, I can't speak for everyone else, but I do want to hear from you. Email me at kirsten@thisweekinscience.com if you have any questions, comments, suggestions for future topics of discussion. And many thanks to Alex and everyone here at Pixel Core. Keith, thanks for joining us once again. And for all the guys behind the scenes who helped to produce and record this podcast.
Joe Lane,
thank you so much. We couldn't do it without you and your hair pulling before the episodes with the technical issues. So thank you very much. And Alex, what shouldn't we forget?
Between shows, don't leave the light on.